So now in the last part of the talk, and it consists of two or three slides, I want to talk about what I see coming in the future. You might have heard the term Web 2.0, Web 2.0. And Web 2.0 is a term, Tim O'Reilly, I believe, and it refers to these architectures of participation. So when a year ago at a conference, I was asked, what do you think comes after Web 2.0? I said, I think it's Web 3.0. And everyone laughed. And then wanted to know, so what is it about? And there are different people have different what Web 3.0 is about. For me, as a person who is interested in people and data, Web 3.0 is, I think, the logical step after only producing stuff, actually to want to know who is the person behind blog. So for me, Web 3.0 is about coming up with smart architectural interaction. I gave you one example before, the example of the phone numbers, which empower people to interact and to have more control over the interaction. Other examples of phone numbers are, just to stick with this as up the stage for Web 3.0. One, if I call you and your phone is busy, so I don't want to leave a voicemail because then you call me back and my phone is busy or I have to, this is awful. So what I want to do is I want to prioritize how important that call is for me, and I want to give you an indication how important it is for me. So maybe I forgot my passport at home, and please come to the airport, bring me a passport, otherwise I will not be able to leave Russia. Or may I just want to check in with you, how is it going, and or do you want to do something next year or next decade or something like that? And then you, an expression of intention of mine, you should be able to allocate your attention to it. And if you said, gee, you know, Andreas, you know, really something very urgent to talk to me about, then as soon as you hang up in your previous phone call, presumably, I actually don't write them. Both our phones should re-ring and said, hello, who is this? And you say, hello, who is this? And so we figure out, oh, yes, that was the leftover phone call from before. So I think that's one product which is coming out in America. Just making telephone conversations better than just, you know, you're in the, you don't know why the phone is ringing.
It's something similar to what Microsoft has in their last Outlook. They have a smart arrangement for your mails in. And this arrangement is inferred from your mail list, your mail history actually. So they automatically arrange and in nice fashion how the priority of mails are based. Soon you reply to the mail from the person. What was the topic? If you reply to them, and so on, so forth.
There's one thing in what Microsoft has. Mark Smith is the guy who did the research on that. And it's not only based on your own behavior, it's a wonderful example again of mining the attention behavior of other people as well. So, for instance, you have never sent me an email, but maybe you have sent Victor an email, and Victor was very eager to reply to you because he wants to hire you. So, now you send me an email. It knows that Victor and I are talking. So, you will have a much higher chance you get read by me, given your emailing behavior with Victor and Victor's emailing with me, then let's say you, who may have written to Victor. Have you written to Victor?
I guess not.
No, no. Okay, so for you, when you write, it's just one of these .ru addresses, and usually they sell, you know, drugs or they sell, you know, sex or, you know, so you probably end up filter because you didn't have that connection with Victor. So I think it's not only your own behavior, but it really is the behavior of your social network which is used in here.
Well, it all sounds great, but you have to gather a large context. Is it technically feasible now? You have to, I have software on my PC, okay, it can parse my emails, that's great, but making a long tracks in the social network, well, in email, it requires a great deal of global context estimation, and it may require to, I don't know, is it feasible?
Probably second effects are enough. So I think you don't have to go further than second order effects, and then you just multiply two matrices. So I think it's not a tactic primarily. Then maybe you don't want the system to observe everybody you're sending email to.
That's the second problem.
And that goes back to what we have said before. Most of the problems are no longer just technological problems, the way you just framed it, but are actually people behavior problems, people and data problems. I'm consulting to the World Economic Forum, which is an event once a year in Davos, and we are building a system that allows the presumably 5 to 10,000 most important people in the world, Mr. Putin, one of them, and of course Angela Merkel and so on, who go to this event in Davos in January, to communicate with each other. And an important element in building the system is finding out what they can discover. So if Mr. Putin and Angela Merkel are the same documents, maybe you don't want to tell Angela she should talk to, what's his first name?
Vladimir.
And talk to Angela. But you might want to say there is another person who is interested in the same stuff. And then you might want to come up with how maybe one of them reveals a little bit about themselves and then the other one reveals a bit about, and then say, oh, we're old friends or not. I don't know. And they will. So it's about discovery. And again, you have to get those incentives right. You have to do it in a way that, you know, not one person reveals and then the other person reveals nothing and uses it to his advantage. So it's about, you know, I don't know what you call it, but, you know, it is about finding out really smart ways, like challenge response, if you will, of coming up with sure what about the other person. So for me, those architectures of interaction are really interesting. Here's one specific example. This company is called Xing, X-I-N-G, and it's a social network primarily for people who are professional people, mainly in Germany. And here's an example of who has been looking at my profile. So it tells me who is interested in me, who has been checking me out. And it says, this is this company, this guy from that company, that guy from this company. So that's interesting. So this already is two architectures of interaction. Because those people don't have to do anything. They just to click on my profile, and it even tells you here how they found me, through which path, and now I know that they were looking at me. There's a dating site, or there's a sort of a college networking site, where you list all the people you have a crush on, and you list all the people you have a crush on, list all the people you have a crush on, and then it won't publish those lists. But if there's a match, if you like a person likes you, then you both get an email. So of course you can abuse the system, you can just put his name, and then you know everybody has a crush on you because you get all these emails. But in any of these cases, you always will sort of get edge cases. You have to play with them and you have to explore them and you see what do people actually do. But I think a lot of work needs to be done in getting this architecture of interaction right, because if you get them wrong, nobody will use them. Another example for architectures of interaction is that maybe you really need to attach a pair value or some currency value to it. It doesn't need to be rubles. It can be doubles or moobles or loodles or whatever. But maybe you want to give people one loodle every day or maybe one loodle every week. And so if you really want to get to know somebody, you collect loodles week after week. And then when you have 10 loodles together, then you finally decide it's time to write to that person. And that person knows that you couldn't get the noodles from anywhere else but waiting for week after week until you finally have your 10 noodles together. So maybe you need to create some artificial rarities, scarcities, in order for people to express that they really have strong intention and strong interest in something.
It's like it's something similar to P2P networks when you want to when someone downloads from you, he gives you a marker, a label. And when you want to download something, you pass the marker forward. So the more you share, the more you can download. So it's something like here. So you collect some reputation, virtual currency, and then you can, you know, the more your reputation is.
Yes, but how do you collect the currency? Will there be a second market for loodles? You might have heard of SecondLife.com. And Second Life has sold $1 billion. And there are actually millionaires by now. I think the first millionaire in real dollars was this woman who lives in Germany, who just did stuff on Second Life. And the exchange rate is, I forgot, maybe 260 million US dollar. And she now is a millionaire in real money, just by buying and selling virtual stuff. And I believe that, I don't believe in standard economics, the stuff about supply and demand, you know, how people should behave if they had rationality. You know, I certainly don't have infinite rationality. But I believe in behavior economics, in finding out how people actually do behave. And bringing things back now to the very beginning here of the talk, when I started talking to you about how people make decisions and so on, I actually skipped over a couple of slides. And back to e-business, here is one question. Selection. Yesterday, went to Ozone. Well, you have the entire spectrum. You have one item a day, a company called Wood.com. You can have one thing. So it might be a wireless router today, and it might be a pair of glasses tomorrow. And you can't return it, no customer, because they get really good prices, and probably you can sell it on some market for more than you would bought it from at Wood.com. Or something called Chibo.com. I'm not sure whether they're in Russia. They're in Russia? Chibo. They make coffee. Yeah, it used to be coffee. By now, they sell everything. So for instance, last week, I went to Hanover, to the train station, and what I learned was that week they were selling winter clothes. Of course, it was cold, so there was nothing left on the shelves. It was empty. But every week they sell one item. It goes a new experience every week. So they already know what they're doing in 52 weeks in the future. It's designed, by the way, that they pick stores at random for next year and see how well the items are doing now. And then based on different stores, so you can't actually figure out what they're doing and sort of outsell them. And then 1 year from now, they know what they're going to put on the shelves, only for a week. So these are two examples where selection is extremely limited. On the other hand, you have a company which sells shoes where you get, I looked at Adidas, you get 286 different kinds of Adidas shoes. You know, I wouldn't know. Or a company called Zazzle.com in Palo Alto, where you have, I think, 100,000 designs which you can choose from. Why? Because they actually do a number of things really well. For instance, you can make stamps. So stamps of Victor, for instance, in the United States, and just put them on my Christmas mail. And they'll be valid. And Zazzle will actually produce them for me. So here in this selection, from Wood, one item a day, to Chibo, every week, one new world. On the other hand, with hundreds of thousands of designs, you have the entire spectrum. The question is, how will people evolve? We, I think, have to deal with much more complexity than our ancestors, or than people during Soviet times, as you mentioned about milk. There was one kind of milk, or rubber boots, or whatever happened to be in the store that week, and the choice was to get it or not to get it. On United Airlines the other day, I was coming over in business class, and the lady said, "Would you like to dine with us?" And what are my choices? And she said, "Well, to dine or not to dine." So one big difference is really how people cope with complexity. And the other one, I think, is, and I'm very curious, is in Russia, that there's a generation gap in people who were born around 1980. So those younger than 25, 26 years old probably are all very used to using Instant Messenger. Instant Messenger is something which you don't experience as an interrupt. Now, those of us who are slightly above 28 are probably not as used to using Instant Messenger. I see you nod, you know, yeah. It's probably not as easy for us. While, you know, one of those rare moments when we can concentrate on something, actually, you know, it says, hey, Snooky Pokey has signed on. Hey, Ponky Gonky has signed on. Hey, I mean, and then Ponky Donkey and Snooky Pooky, they all want to talk to me. Hey, man. So it's just a different word for us. And the question is, how much has that changed the hardwiring of people? Is it that the generation of people who grew up, totally grew up with the internet, that, you know, if you were born in 1980, you were 13, 14 when the web took off. So it's just absolutely normal for you to constantly being connected with your friends versus the older, not as connected. Email is actually something for old people in the Bay Area. So, you know, you're nodding here. It's maybe the same in Russia. You don't really, do you use a lot of email?
Yes, of course.
To whom? Or your old person too, but I mean, besides that.
To
job.
You mean instead of
texting? Yeah, texting.
Well, work, everything you have to type, mostly business things.
Business things, right. But with your friends?
Rarely,
right.
Never actually.
Actually, yeah. That's what people say, that it's less, much less used. So I think closing my talk now and opening up for a moment. We closed by talking about architectures of interaction. So this talk really is about technology. It's about designs. And the last part, of course, is about designing interactions. We have seen dramatic shifts in those 20 years I started with. 86, very few people at email. 96, you said you're not using email to talk. 2006, you said you're not using email to talk to your friends anymore. So 20 years is a reasonable lifetime in a person. Dramatic shifts have happened. How do we design interactions so actually people will actually use them and enjoy them? How do we sequentially reveal information about each other? How do we allow people to discover each other? One of the features I want to build into that system for the World Economic Forum has three buttons. One, who wants to talk to me? Who should be talking to me? Second button is, who should I be talking? And the third button is, where are those probabilities, the product of those two probabilities, reasonably big? So where do I think action I can have a dialogue? Maybe I want to talk to Putin, but maybe Putin doesn't want to talk to me. But maybe I want to talk, maybe Victor wants to talk to you, and yeah, maybe we have a similar deal. That's why I'm here in Moscow. And maybe the other people want to talk to me, but I don't want to talk to them. So I think, how do we design these things? What algorithms do we use? And what incentives do we have for people to take part in that new world? I think these are the challenges which I have for smart people here at Moscow State University in computer science who want to work on interesting things. And one thing is clear in this world of transparency and world of basically zero communication time, that if you have a really good idea, that the world will adopt it. So I encourage you to think hard about pictures of interaction. Let me thank you for your attention here. Thank you. And no questions.
Okay, I may share my opinion and ask you a question. From these examples you gave, it seems like web goes, it becomes even more personal than before. So for an uneducated person, for an unprepared person, it's weird that people know about him even before he enters the site, that they offer him books he likes and he doesn't understand what this is. So if you have one committed user, you can just milk him for the rest of his life, business kind of interest. So how should internet users and offline people be educated not to be afraid of using internet and
isn't it scaring actually?
Right, because some people will never use it in the present state of how internet is being popular.
Wasn't that experience with statistic and probability what was scaring to you because someone is watching?
So in America, and I mentioned MySpace, and I've noticed that MySpace is not so popular here. But in America, the saying goes, there are two kinds. There are those who know their children are in MySpace, and those who don't know their children. So I think this is a good question, but people who grow up now have a very different attitude to their online lives. I mean, when you apply for a job, do you need to say what your life journal idea is? Do you need to apply with, and here's my blog. These are the thoughts I had in the last 7 years.
But your employer may find your blog.
Oh, yes, maybe you might not think about it, but I know about stories about a company in America, I forgot which one, where actually people were not given a job because they were pictured in some parties enjoying themselves a little bit more than the employer thought they should have been enjoying. But I think we'll get over that intermittent time where people get upset or get uptight about, you know, you doing things with funny people somewhere. And since everyone does funny things with funny people every now and then, the fact that it's about all of us, everyone, somewhere out on the web, and that it's not that hard to figure out that Andreas Weigand has as a pseudonym, this was the thing with the persistent history, A. Weigand on the web. That is, unless I have some other pseudonym, of course. That is not that hard anymore. So I think attitude towards their personal data is just going to be very different. You actually expect to walk in somewhere into a new website, and that website to already know your name and your zip code and your age and what you're interested in, stuff like that. It's so different if you walk into a store here, even a store you have never been to. They know from the way you shave your head and from your glasses, stuff like this, from your jeans, you know, torn out like this, from your shoes, they know you're a certain kind of guy. And you, you know, convey that. And you're different from the ladies. And that situation and that personality, that actually is going to be committed, conveyed, I think, in normal life. And it was only through this period. There was this German guy called Gutenberg. Have you heard of him?
Sure.
Yeah, so there was a period. It started with Gutenberg and ended sometime at the end of the last millennium, where people actually felt that they should write down things and they had catalogs. Everybody pays the same price. Funny how that worked. And, you know, before it made sense, because if you go to the market and you see this green lettuce there, which you really would love to have, because you'd have a sweetheart over for dinner that evening, you're willing to pay a little bit more to the lady than trade. Or, you know, nowadays, if you're somewhere on the internet, like on eBay, you really want that something. You're happy to pay a little more. And there was only this period where this communication was broken. The communication is now there, that you can talk to everybody you want to talk to. And I can talk to everybody you want to talk to. But there was a time in between where you send out millions of catalogs, but you had no information coming back. And so that is, I think, very unhuman in some way. So that's why I'm pushing for those architecture. And as I said before, the problem I see there about your personal data is, what if something is wrong? What ways can we invent? So if something's wrong about you, you can fix it. But if Victor pretends he's you and wants to change something which is right about you to actually something is wrong about it, he can't do it. These are difficult things.
Yeah. Can I see, what an offline promotion for such a big store as Amazon.com should be like? There are people who don't know that Amazon exists, and they still buy books the ordinary way. And how do resources like, I don't know, YouTube.com get promoted? And what's the best way for people to find out about them? I think like outside billboards or magazine ads.
You know what?
So this
my offer.
Let me answer this. So we can derive this from the principles we have set up today, if you will, from the axioms we have set up today. And that is that communication is basically free. So that means, how do you promote things? By viral nature. So YouTube, as an example. To my knowledge, also, you might know, for instance, Google never had big bulletin boards where it says Google, buy stuff, come to Google. The way it worked is that when you do something, they will insert a message that actually it is via Google. The better example for this actually is Hotmail. The canonical example is Hotmail, where if you have a Hotmail account and you send me an email, at the bottom of the email, get your own free Hotmail account. Another even better example is Skype. Do you know Skype? So Skype, you send me an email. Say, I'm not a Skype user, you're a Skype user. Say, hey, Andreas, you want to talk to me for free? On free? Just download those 20 megabyte, click install, and then we'll be in business. Here's my user ID. And my user ID, I download it, and I'm a user ID, and we are doing something which you couldn't do before. So for the business question, there are two matters. What is the customer acquisition cost? And how much do you make out of the customer? Your customer acquisition cost is dramatically different now from before because communication is free. And what you can make out of the customer might be the same as before, because people spend roughly the same money they did before. But by the acquisition cost having dropped by 1, 2, 3 orders of magnitude in some cases, particularly marketing, you can have just very different spreading of whatever you want to spread in terms of product. So no longer boons, but try to attach the messages to what's traveling. And that's where the notion viral comes from. That just attaches it, you know how it works. Attaches it and then travels with the other thing.
So my offer is, Andreas is staying here for this evening. So there is a cafeteria at the second floor. I pay, you take beverages and ask Andreas if you have other questions, because I see that probably many of you are already tired. If you have questions, move to the second floor to the cafeteria and continue our dialogue.
Great plan.
So
the question, of course, is do they have vodka on the second floor?
I guess no vodka, but I guess something's there. So we can move there on the second floor and continue.
One question maybe before moving to cafe.
Okay.
What do you think about Russia specific? For example, I must know that YouTube was acquired by $1.6 billion. And it is very popular in USA. What do you think if this kind of service will be launched in Russia? You know, the quality of content is the primary thing there. Do you think it is possible to create quality content in Russia? Because if we are talking about the scale of distribution, we will not get the quality content which will be very popular in the whole audience. And our price of company is out. What do you think?
So, first of all, I am not sure whether we do have a notion of quality or whether we basically have deconstructed the quality and replaced it by page views or downloads. For instance, I was giving a talk at a large, actually a very large German retailer, and I went on YouTube. And that's a retailer which also has physical stores. And if you go to YouTube and enter the name of that retailer, the most popular movie is a guy and a girl doing it in the elevator of that retailer. So, you know, I'm not high quality. I think it was just them showing, you know, that they can take a movie while they do it in the elevator. But it just simply shows you interesting stuff bubbles up. Now, they were really aghast by having their name associated with that movie. And I said, what's the problem? Nobody really thinks that you're a good store or a bad store just because, you know, a guy and a girl do it in the elevator in your store. And so you have to really think about the notion of quality is just, I think, pretty much an artificial notion which was introduced to the keepers. In socialist days, quality was, you know, think about the films made then, and I know more about East Germany because my mom is really than about the Soviet Union in that days. But there was a different notion of what quality was than what quality is, and probably of what quality will be in year 10 of YouTube. And about Russia specific, look, I spent a total of certainly less than a week of my life in Russia. So I, to be honest, really don't know about any Russia specific things, but maybe I want to turn here the word for the last few minutes over to Victor. He, having been the CTO of MailRU with 20 million people, has much more to say in terms of insights on this question than I would have.
Well, I just also did not understand the problem with quality. That depends on the definition.
The problem is of quality is to define the best movie to attract new participants.
Well, the idea is
very vague definition is the best. For one person, the best is one. For the other, the other. This the long tail. This the long tail idea is clearly about that quality preferences are not the same for everyone. And new technologies, now we can offer not only what is happening to movie industry now. Using
you can see, every week you can see only a couple of movies, actually. But with the development of YouTube and other services, you can probably see less movies in less quality, not filmed, you know, good quality film, but taken by cell phone. But those movies probably are much more funny and interesting than.
And the culture is degrading.
Culture is always degrading. Culture is always degrading. The next one is always worse than the previous one. If you start thinking this.
What do you think this innovations on interactions so will affect the actual culture?
That is a question for our dinner and vodka, but before we do this, let me simply. You know, the quality notion, here's another reason why I think our old notions, which is, you know, need to light, you know, the world, you know, we are in now. For instance, the fact that people watch movies, if you shot really high quality film on those little devices, you know, called iPods, you know, without search, you know, you can just, you know, run it. And then they share it. I mean, you know, what experience is that? I mean, maybe you're close to the other person because you both need to really get close to that display. But besides that, that was never the way the movie was intended. But as Roland Barthes said, death of the author, no matter how it was intended, it doesn't really matter, you know, what we consider as quality or some other gatekeepers consider as quality. As long as people are happy and learning, as people are free to choose out of a plethora of things, and as long as our job is to provide them with tools to discover which they actually wouldn't have known how to look for, and then also to discover to be free to not use stuff which they discovered. I think for me, that's as far as I personally can think. Time to go to the cafeteria?
Yeah, I guess.
Okay, so thank you.